Majors and Quinn presents Holly Hughes with BJ Hollers.
So tonight, I am very excited to welcome two wonderful writers to our store, Holly Hughes and BJ Hollers. So Holly J. Hughes is the author of Sailing by Ravens, the co-author of The Pen and the Bell, Mindful Writing in a Busy World, and editor of the award-winning anthology Beyond Forgetting, Poetry and Prose about Alzheimer's Disease. She has spent over 30 summers working on the water in Alaska commercial fishing for salmon, skippering a 65-foot schooner, and working as a naturalist on ships. She lives in Washington State, dividing her time between a log cabin in Indianola, and built in the 1930s, and a home on 3 acres in Shimicum, and teaches writing and mindfulness workshops. She will be sharing her book, Passings, today, which is a beautiful book of poetry on, as the title of the event suggests, extinct birds. BJ Hollers is the author of several books, most recently From the Mouths of Dogs, What Our Pets Teach Us About Life, Death, and Being Human, as well as a collection of essays, This Is Only a Test. Next year, in early February, Flock Together, A Love Affair with Extinct Birds, will be published by the University of Nebraska Press. So that is the book he will be sharing tonight. As I just said, it's not out yet, but he does have postcards, so you won't forget about it. Holler serves as a mentor for Creative Nonfiction, the reviews editor for Pleiades, okay, and a contributing blogger for Brainchild and Michigan Quarterly Review. In addition, he is the founder of the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild. He is currently an assistant professor of English at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Now, please join me in welcoming our first reader, Holly Hughes.
Thank you, Anne. Can you hear me okay? Okay, good. So Anne and I are a duo on this. I'm giving her the sign and she will advance. This is in lieu of a remote, or she's my remote, I guess. So go ahead. So thank you to, first of all, Majors and Quinn. I'm just so grateful for all of our independent bookstores. Long may they live, and it's up to us to support them. So just a reminder, I read here in 2009 from Beyond Forgetting, and it's just so nice to be back here. Also, thanks to Anne. She's been terrific in all of the logistical support and in this wonderful kind of blind date with BJ at the very last minute. So I'm really pleased that this all came together. And thank you all for being here. I know it's Labor Day weekend, and you could be off doing something really exciting, but I'm really glad you're here, and we'll have a good time. A good reading together. So I'm going to start out with the poetry part of this reading, and I'd like to start out by reading a little bit of prose just to give you some context. It's really, I've given a number of readings from this book, but it's really great to be here in Minnesota. I grew up in Minnesota. I was born in Winona. I really grew up in northern Minnesota on the shores of Little Boy Lake as well, and a number of my friends are here to witness that. And so really this collection started many years ago. So I'm going to read from the preface that talks a little bit about sort of early encounters with birds. And Audubon calls the first bird that you connect with your spark bird. So be thinking about what your spark bird might be. And I'll start with an epigraph from Katie Ford, a wonderful poet if you don't know her work. Some things qualify as silence, but they wake us. Like the disappearance of bird call that kept us asleep because we took it as dream stitch. An early memory, flash of scarlet against tall drifts of snow. A cardinal swoops to the feeder outside our kitchen window. That's how I learned the color red. And from then on, I always associated red with that cardinal, which seemed a friend as it showed up each morning for its oily black sunflower seeds that my father provided, no matter how deep the drifts. When I look back on my life, I see that birds have always been part of my family, speaking to me, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. I remember waddling behind a flock of mallards soon after learning to walk, intent on joining them. Later, while at summer camp in northern Minnesota, I recall an encounter with a great blue heron on a lake at dusk. The heron balances, motionless, on one leg in the tall reeds as the setting sun suffuses the sky, the heron's ball-bearing eye peering into my own. Loons began calling to me, their wild laugh beckoning me north and west, and I followed, finding myself fishing in Alaska with a whole raft of seabirds to meet. Horned and tufted puffins, ancient murrelets, whiskered auklets, pigeon guillemots. I soon came to recognize them as new members of my family. The smooth white breast of the common murre perched on rocky ledges, the orange legs of the black oyster catcher pacing the shoreline, the quick, nervous dive of the phalarope. When the Exxon Valdez fetched up on Bly Reef in 1989, I left my job writing catalog copy and flew to Alaska to work on the spill. I was given a job running the medic boat and picking up oiled seabirds to take to the rehabilitation center in Seward. As we scooped up each limp body in a net, each seabird felt like a death among my own family. These days, the birds in my life are fewer but still distinct. Cormorants hanging their wings out to dry as I wait for the ferry to take me to work each morning. The kingfisher perched on the telephone line above the slough as I drive home each afternoon. The osprey that follows me up the beach. The pileated woodpecker that drums the stump outside my writing studio. The lilting call of the Swainson's thrush on evening walks. I can't imagine my life without birds, even if their presence is fleeting. They are my family, my relations. Without them, my world would be a less vibrant, less musical place. Like birds, poems are fleeting, flitting through our consciousness before they come to roost in our hearts. Maybe it was inevitable that poetry and birds would come together for me. This series began more than a decade ago, fittingly, with Audubon's iconic painting of the passenger pigeon. Decades earlier, I'd found a print in a used bookstore in Sitka, Alaska, and I was haunted by it. I still remember this. I kept coming back again and again to the bookstore, and then I finally bought the print. Then it stayed rolled up in my closet for another 10 years or so, and finally I matted it and hung it on the wall. And I woke up the next morning, and the birds seemed to be asking for a poem. So I wrote a poem, and then they seemed to want company. And so that they really started it. I said, okay, I started researching more extinct birds. And I found, of course, that there was no shortage of choices. And that's really how this collection started. I'm very good at starting poetry projects. Finishing them is another story. This was a hard collection to finish. There's a lot of extinct birds out there, and I could have just kept going. But at some point, I realized I needed to finish it, and partly what inspired me to finish it was the 100th anniversary of Martha's passing in 2014. And I also was lucky enough to meet up with the publisher, Expedition Press, a beautiful letterpress publisher who offered to publish it. And so, of course, that was a good reason to say yes and to finish it. So I wanted to mention too that serendipitously there's a review, or not a review, I'm sorry, an interview that's appearing in Rain Taxi that will be out in 2 days. It was almost out in time for this reading, but it talks a little bit about how I got together with Expedition Press, so, and about the whole art of letterpress as well, which is also endangered. So it's a fitting combination. So I'm going to start with the passenger pigeon. Whoops. And actually, can you go back, Anne? I just wanted to read this. This is in the book, but I just think this is a beautiful quote. I also wanted to acknowledge the author of the book, Hope is the Thing with Feathers. I got a lot of wonderful information from this book, and I know that BJ did as well. Knowing whatever we can about these vanished birds restores them to a habitat we still can save. Our moral imagination. And I have to also acknowledge there's a whole list at the back of my book of all the books that I read to produce this very thin volume. So I really view this as a collaboration with many other writers and painters who I was inspired by. So the first poem is The Passenger Pigeon. I described finding it in the painting by James J. Audubon in Sitka. So this is an ekphrastic poem. So it's really just describing what you see in the painting. See how she bends to him, her beak held within his, while she waits for his food to rise up to her hunger. He rests on the arcing branch, his neck a perfect answer to hers, wings held aloft and slightly splayed, while long tail feathers stream away, Prussian blue going to dusk, breast russet, branch below studded with viridian lichen to match his coat, colors chosen by Audubon as he painted them in courtship in situ. See how her colors foreshadow the fall, dun mustard black, how her tail balances his wings painted in parallel planes, how the drooping oak leaf holds them in place, stasis in which they are aware of no one but each other. Audubon captured them in gouache, graphite, and pastels, not knowing they would soon be gone. In his time, they were no more numerous than all other species combined. They say the pigeons flew over the banks of the Ohio River for 3 days in succession, sounding like a hard gale at sea. Years later, guns splattered shot into skies stormy with pigeons. Thousands plummeted, filling railroad cars bound for fine restaurants. Now, of those hundreds of millions that once darkened the skies, we are left with Martha, who never lived in the wild, stuffed in the Smithsonian, Prussian blue feathers stiff, glass eyes staring, waiting, still, for her mate. It was a common story at that time, going from the passenger pigeon being so plentiful, it's inconceivable, I think, to us to imagine how that could have happened, right? It wouldn't happen today. When we get down to the last one or two of every species, they have radio collars and tags, and they're being tracked, but they're elusive, and BJ will get to that. The next example, the Labrador duck, was another example of a species that was very plentiful. And I think when I'm tempted to be judgmental, I'm reminded that this poem reminds me not to be, this story of the Labrador duck. And I'm also reminded, you know, that what are we doing now that our children's children might be questioning later? Labrador duck. Your black and white plumage earned you many names, skunk duck, pied duck, and worst of all, fool duck. To you, the distinction of being the first species among endemic North American birds to go extinct. Ornithologists can't say exactly why, since you, unlike some birds, could fly. Perhaps your diet of mollusks, shoveled and sifted in the shallows by your unique beak. Perhaps your eggs were too easy to harvest. Perhaps your trusting nature made you an easy mark for hunters. Perhaps because your flesh rotted quickly in the open-air markets of Baltimore, mindless revenge on a creature deemed useless. But when you flew, your wings whistled as you tried to escape a pound of double B fired from the ducking sloops, killing or wounding hundreds at a shot. Your numbers dropped. No one believed you, so numerous, could be wiped out. One by one, you took your leave until a December day in 1878 in the lowlands outside Elmira, New York. A young lad shot a black and white duck, packed it home to his hungry family who were grateful to eat, who could not know they were eating the last Labrador duck. The Carolina Parakeet. And the epigraph for this also ended up in the Cincinnati Zoo. Inca's the last Carolina parakeet, died in his cage at the Cincinnati Zoo on February 21st, 1918, only 6 months after the death of Lady Jane, his companion of 32 years. From Mexico to New York they flew, tail feathers streaming, startling in the monochrome of winter's eastern shore. When their forests were cut, they swooped to the farmlands in waves of color, yellow, green, orange, lit in fruit trees, found the soft squish of peaches, cherries, figs. Descending 300 at a time in crayon box flocks, they were shot by farmers defending their crops. Who could fault them? Shot for their tail feathers, all the rage on ladies' hats. Shot because they would not desert each other, each staying by its wounded mate until hunters pick them off, one by each last bright, exotic, faithful one. And now all the species I've read so far have been North American birds, and this one is a Hawaiian bird, obviously, by the title. And their challenges were different, being an island species. Considered royal, their brilliant plumage once adorned the robes of Hawaiian kings. Large and confident, the o'o were trapped, choice yellow feathers plucked from tufts beneath their wings, woven into sacred robes, then released back to the wild. If not released, they were eaten, a great delicacy when fried in their own fat, native Hawaiians reported. Though their feathers had been plucked for generations, they were still plentiful when Captain Cook landed. The Europeans brought avian diseases, cleared the land, collected them as songbirds. In 1898, the musket arrived, and thousands fell from the skies. The last Hawaiian o'o sighted on the slopes of Mauna Loa was still singing, still listening for its mate. It's a very haunting call. Okay, this bird I really struggled with. I read a whole book by David Quammen called The Song of the Dodo. It's a wonderful book, and I didn't know where to start. You know, the book is about that fat. You know, how do you boil that down to a poem? So I ended up just, you know, starting and stopping, throwing stuff away, and then finally, just a tactic I've learned over the years when I get really stuck with poems, just addressing the bird directly. Okay, so this is To the Dodo. And when I did that, a phrase came back to me from my childhood. So this is Dodo. Oh, Dodo, how can so little be known about you, most maligned of extinct birds? I encountered you first on the school playground as an insult, looked you up in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and found you in an artist's drawing based on reports from sailors, looking fat and stupid, even to me then. And already you were gone, gone the way of the dodo. Later, I learned you were just a clumsy relative of pigeons who'd lost your ability to fly. You had no predators before European sailors arrived on the shores of Mauritius, sailors who took your trusting nature as a sign of stupidity. Cursed by evolution and the easy judgment of sailors, you didn't even taste good. The Dutch called you disgusting bird. Still, you became a source of meat for passing sailors, but that's not what did you in. You laid only one egg, your nest on the ground plundered by dogs, pigs, and monkeys brought to the island by ship. Accounts tell us you were once exhibited live on the streets of London, a curiosity. What's curiouser still is this. 100 years later, you were gone. What remains are the bones of your head and foot at Oxford, a few more bones scattered across museums in Europe and Mauritius. Not even drawings of you can be verified. We have only this pejorative, you dodo, as proof that you once walked the earth, doomed by your trusting nature. Your extinction, a cautionary tale, if we don't prove to be dodos ourselves. You're supposed to laugh at that last line. This is the humor in the book. I promised everybody a little bit of levity. There it is. Thank you to the Dodo for providing us with some levity. But it is a fascinating story, and if you're interested in a really good read, I highly recommend that book. I mean, it is amazing how little is known about this bird that has sort of become, is so iconic of extinct birds, that there's so little left of it. And I'll end on the ivory-billed woodpecker, which in my collection is the last poem, so it's the perfect segue into BJ's reading, who focused on that in his memoir. And I wanted to end on this bird because there's controversy over whether or not it's really gone, but I'll let BJ get into that. Ivory-billed woodpecker. I wish I'd been at the sighting that inspired its nickname, the Lord God Bird. I'd love to see this woodpecker, perhaps extinct, perhaps not, no one knows for sure. Standing 20 inches tall with white wing patches and a flashy red crest, who wouldn't say, Lord God, look at that. Once it made its home in the hardwood forests of the South, birders say its ivory bill could pierce bark 8 inches deep. Imagine the racket. Even so, they were vulnerable. A single pair needed 6 square miles of wet forest with dead trees in which to search for grubs. In 1948, when a Louisiana forest was cleared for a soy plantation, the last population vanished. The Cuban subspecies survived a few more decades, but by 1970, logging had reduced its population to 8 pairs. In the 1990s, explorers in the mountains near Moa found fresh signs of feeding, caught a glimpse of a bird that might have been the ivory bill, but that sighting was never confirmed. Since then, more reports have surfaced, suggesting the Lord God bird may not be gone. A few still hide, spectral spirits, reminding us of the shimmering line linking memory and desire, reminding us that perhaps it's not too late to save them. To save us all. Thank you.
You know, the great thing about getting birders together, can you hear me okay? Is that the first thing we discuss is the spark bird. So no sooner had I met Holly when she said, you know, the cardinal was my spark bird. And of course, I have the worst spark bird because mine is the ivory-billed woodpecker, which I will very likely never see flying through the skies. Thank you so much again to Anne for putting this together, and Holly, what a wonderful, wonderful grouping. I couldn't believe this. I emailed Anne and said, hey, you know, if you ever need someone to read about extinct birds or something, and she said, how about Sunday? So that worked out very well. I'm never going to hear that again. I don't have the book out, I'm afraid, but I do have some postcards as guaranteed, so I'll let my former academic assistant back there pass them around for us if we need to. But thanks so much, and of course, plenty of good books up to support the bookstore at the end of the reading. So, I guess this book started with another book. It's called Lost Animals. I was kind of wandering through the thrift stores in town, and I came across this book, and it was a really surprising and sort of shocking book. It's a coffee table book of photographs of extinct animals. And it's shocking because it seems so anachronistic, you know, that we can live in a time when we could take a photograph of a particular animal, but we couldn't find a way to preserve it in real life. All we have left are the photos, which was a strange thing. And I really wanted to try to preserve some of these creatures, specifically the birds, in a different way as well. Tried the poetry route, found out probably best to leave that to Holly. So I went back to the prose route. And I think there's a really compelling story to tell with these extinct species of birds. I think they are in many ways made for poetry. I mean, one example, and it just kind of took my heart away, is what we call the last representative of a species. Anyone know what we call the last representative of a species? The endling. The endling. If you go to Wikipedia, there's a whole page of famous endlings. We always give them individual names, Inca, all of these kind of things, Martha. And we really humanize these creatures. We don't seem to care that much about them when there are a lot of them, but when there's one left, we tend to give them a name and give them their due. So started with the book photography, and then I kind of started thinking about different ways to represent these creatures. So this follows three different strands. The passenger pigeon, which we already learned about. wildly tragic story, how the most abundant bird on the planet can be reduced to zero within half a human lifetime. Within 40 years, we took the most abundant bird and made it zero. The ivory-billed woodpecker, of course. There's my guy. And the tragedy there of, you know, there was a chance we could save this population. There were, you know, six or so left in the Singer Tract in Louisiana. A lot of governors, the National Audubon Society gathered their money, gathered their resources, said to the Chicago Lumber Company, would you just spare these acres, please? Could you just save this bit of land for this bird? And they said, as I'll read, nah, we're just money grubbers. And so decided for the rest of us that we would never be able to see these birds again. And then finally, the third thread of the book kind of follows the more memoir moments of this book. The subtitle is A Love Affair with Extinct Birds. I can assure you my wife was shocked to hear about this love affair I've been having. But I think the marketers really wanted to talk about the memoir-y aspects, which is just simply a guy who's not a birder, who's not much of an environmentalist. I recycle. It's about the extent of it, and who's really trying to find a way into this world. And so I partnered with a local guy who's just an incredible birder. And, you know, if this was, you know, the Karate Kid, he would be the Mr. Miyagi in the situation. He taught me so much and really put me through my paces. So I'll read three brief sections from the book, beginning with the opening pages. It's so good to see the former students. Gosh, I haven't seen some of you folks in like years. It's just so wonderful. Thanks for coming out. Had the birds not come searching for me, I might not have gone searching for them. But they did. One warm September afternoon, just as I sat down for lunch. At first I mistook their tapping for a knock on the front door, but as I moved toward it, it was evident that the sound was coming from elsewhere. I returned to the table, reached for my soup, when suddenly the knocking repeated. Tap, 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 tap. I stood at attention, peeked out the back door, and saw nothing. Tap, 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 tap. Turning at whiplash speed, I caught a glimpse of a small speckled frame gripping the screen door with his claws. His tapping repeated, tap, 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 prompting me to crane my neck to get a better view. Woodpecker, I cried to my wife and young children, bounding over baby carriers and bouncers until reaching my phone. We got a live one here. 21st century birder that I am, or had become in the days preceding my first conscious sighting, I clicked on my Audubon Birds Pro application, scrolling past everything between albatross and wood warbler before reaching the digital family of woodpeckers aglow on my screen. Fifth on the list were the downies, complete with a near-identical photo of the bird I just encountered. There he was, white-bellied and red-patched and just an inch or two longer than my fist. It's you, I thought. You're my guy. Upon appearing back out the window, I learned that my guy was only one half of a pair. A moment later, his counterpart greeted me, a female downy who blurred past my feeder, taking refuge in the backyard birch. I didn't quite know the protocol for what to do next. The answer, I now know, is to keep quiet and enjoy the show. Bumbling birder that I was, I did the opposite. I clicked on the application's audio feature, blasted Winnie Call number 2 from my phone's speaker. The recorded call bleated through the screen door and infiltrated my yard. It was enough to frighten the female back into flight, though the male, more curious than scared, momentarily observed me from his nearby roost. Our eyes locked, and then, just as quickly as he'd come, he disappeared into the trees. That was it. That was everything. The birds had called. And I'd answered. When I first learned of extinction, I hardly learned of extinction at all. Instead, I learned of the phenomenon's poster child, the dodo, a flightless, feathered, football-shaped bird that by the late 1600s had marched his pigeon-like legs into oblivion. Of course, we humans paved that trail, hunting them until their numbers dwindled, then allowing an invasive species of wild pig to finish the job. In third grade science class, we never quite got around to the finger-pointing. Certainly there was no discussion of the relentless assaults by sailors and swine on the remote island that he called home. Instead, we at our desks were mostly content just staring at paintings of that silly-looking bird, a creature we never knew existed beyond the confines of Disney's Alice in Wonderland. When our teacher explained to us that the dodo was more than a movie star, that in fact it had once existed, her explanation managed only to spur further questions. What did she mean by once, I wondered. How could something that once existed no longer exist anywhere in the world? I took my teacher's claim as a challenge, and that very afternoon wandered the woods behind my Indiana home in search of what hadn't been seen in well over 300 years. While I spotted the usual array of Midwestern avian inhabitants, a preponderance of robins and finches and crows, I was surprised to find not a single dodo among them. After an exhaustive 15-minute investigation, I faced facts. The dodo, it seemed, did not live anywhere in my backyard. Which proves nothing, I decided as I tromped home for dinner that night. After all, every house on the block had a backyard, plenty of places for some silly-looking bird to hide. To say that I was in dodo denial would be an understatement. Frankly, I was a hell-bent 9-year-old cut from the same cloth as Ahab, motivated, at least I thought, not by some deep inner turmoil, but an innate desire to prove my teacher wrong. In retrospect, I can now admit that perhaps my struggle to grasp the dodo's extinction was, in fact, related to my own inner turmoil, namely my inability to come to grips with what seemed impossible, that entire species could vanish on a large scale. If the rumors were true and the dodo was extinct, then what prevented other species from joining them? Of course, plenty of species have, 5 mass extinctions worth, though it wasn't until 9-year-old me began poring over my local library's collection of illustrated dinosaur books that I began to rethink my own dodo-related doubt. It was one thing for some football-shaped bird to hide, but where the hell were the dinosaurs? There was no denying it. The facts were now clear. Probably, they were hiding together. So I'll leap ahead here. I guess I'll go to the ivory bill next. He's right there. Crazy encounter over the weekend. I was in Duluth, and I was grabbing a malt shake with the family, and I was talking to a guy next to me, an elderly gentleman, who I'd known previously in the summer. I met him at a writer's retreat. He asked me about my writing. I said, oh, I'm working on this bird book, Extinction. And he said, oh, you know who my brother is, right? I said, no. Turns out his brother is the guy who led the search for the ivory-billed woodpecker. He's a very well-known ornithologist, top 5. I'm terrified for him to read the book. I think he's going to hate it. But I emailed him the next day, and hey, I just had a milkshake with your brother. I wrote this book. Here's what I say about the ivory-billed woodpecker search. And he was really cool and really appreciative of the book, having not read it yet, because it's a hard story to tell. I mean, the short version is, you know, in 1944, we sort of thought we saw it for the last time. I'll read a brief portion from that. And then in 2004, there were some additional sightings. There's, you know, a 9-second video clip, tens of millions of dollars, literally over $10 million of taxpayer money was spent on this search for the ivory-billed woodpecker. Thousands of hours of people out in canoes in the bayous of Arkansas, looking for this bird. And what I write in the book is I say something like, look, what would we have preferred? That the scientist decided not to try at all, that he just ignored it and thought, we'll just spare our reputation, not even give it a go. I kind of admire that they did give it a go. It cost us a lot of money. We learned a lot. We protected other animals in the process. And though we didn't definitively find the ivory-billed woodpecker, it certainly brought a lot more attention to these issues. So I guess the moral of the story is, if you're trying to talk to someone but you're a little afraid, just go drink a milkshake in Duluth and the world will take care of the rest for you. So this is about my attempt to come as close as I could to the ivory-billed woodpecker. We saw her for the last time in 1944, frantic, wild-eyed, twitching about in her tree. Or rather, 23-year-old wildlife artist Don Eckelberry saw her, having traveled south to Louisiana's Singer Track to sketch America's last ivory-billed woodpecker. It was a less than ideal situation. After all, National Audubon Society President John Baker would have much preferred to have found a way to save the bird rather than dispatch a man to sketch her. However, after negotiations with the Chicago Lumber Company broke down, we're just money grubbers, the company's chairman allegedly said, Baker wasn't left with much of a choice. Since the land couldn't be spared, and by extension, the bird, Baker sent Eckelberry south in the hopes the artist might preserve her image. The woodpecker, known also as the Lord God Bird, for the phrase most often uttered upon seeing one, was paying a high price for man's destruction. For decades, we'd halved their habitat, felling the cypress trees to smithereens, the hollers of timber, 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 droning out the Kent calls from those birds. And then one day, those birds became that bird, and that bird became the only one left to sketch. The black-crested female made herself available to the man with the sketchbook down below, posed, pecked, trumpeted her fading call. Frantic and wild-eyed himself, Eckleberry saved what part of her he could. For 2 weeks, he tracked her, writing and sketching every last detail. Eckleberry went where she went, taking a boat upriver past Alligator Bayou, then a car to John's Bayou, and finally began loitering around the Roost Tree, his ear cocked and awaiting the sound of her call. At around 6:30 p.m., as the barred owls hooted in anticipation of their evening hunt, their calls were interrupted by another sound. Eckleberry and his guide froze, awaiting confirmation of what they thought they heard. And there it was again, an unmistakable note, followed by a rap echoing through the trees. For 13 minutes, the men heard her, anxiously awaiting her grand entrance. Finally, amid the downies and the red bellies, came the long-awaited woodpecker, her wings, according to Eckleberry, cleaving the air in strong direct flight as she alighted with one magnificent upward swoop. But in a less heroic description, he also made note of her hysterical pale eyes and her frantic aliveness, descriptions he tried to capture in his sketches. 70 years later and 1,000 miles away, while perusing a manila folder in Wausau, Wisconsin's Lee Yawkey Woodson Art Museum, I find what remains of those sketches. I traveled to the museum for the extinct bird exhibition, anxious to see paintings of passenger pigeons and great auks and representations of all the birds we'll never see again. But I never expected to find Eckleberry's last sketches of America's last ivory bill, at least not until the curator offhandedly mentioned to me that she had them in her office. The curator and I wound through the museum's stairwells and corridors until arriving there. As I opened the folder and held the sketches in my hands, I could feel a bit of both artist and subject alongside me. What must it have been like, I wonder, to watch a species disappear before his eyes? And what must it have been like to be the last of her kind, offering her call only to hear the echo call back? As I stare at Eckleberry's sketches, my waxing poetic turns suddenly practical. I noticed that in half of the sketches, including the portrait, the female's black crest is sketched red, the clear marking of a male. Which means nothing on its own, merely that Eckleberry was, perhaps, taking a bit of creative license to offer posterity a depiction of both. Unless, I think, it means everything. My conspiracy theory goes a little like this. Well aware of the attention he'd draw by acknowledging the existence of a breeding pair, Eckleberry remained mum instead, reported only the female, thereby protecting the privacy of the world's last chance for an egg. And maybe deep in the hole in the roosting tree there was an egg, or two eggs, or enough eggs to keep our Lord God bird alive a while longer. Perhaps he kept his truth hidden in his sketches, until a decade or so after his death, when some poor fool who wanted too much to believe in the bird's resurrection suddenly found some new reason to do so. Of course, I think, staring at the red crest aflame in the sketches stretched before me. But, of course, not also. What I need is some long-lost letter to confirm it, though when no such letter makes itself available, I make do with an unpublished Eckleberry poem instead. Another clue, I think, reaching toward the carefully typed script. In his untitled poem, Eckleberry wrote, "Mostly we are preserved in life beyond our time, glazed, pickled, set in amber, and casketed above the ground." Casketed above the ground. In silence, I return the poem to its place inside the folder. What if, I think, her echo wasn't an echo after all, but a hello, sweetheart. Welcome home. One very short word, and I'll get off the stage. The last one's on the passenger pigeon here. A century after the last one's death, I strike out in search of a passenger pigeon, or at least what's left of them, a stone monument in Wisconsin's Wyalusing State Park. I drive south, spot an eagle, some tree sparrows, until reaching the park's entrance, which has not been plowed and poses a challenge for my front-wheel drive. The car crawls to a halt near Long Valley Road, not far from an ice-encrusted volleyball net. The park is a freshly shaken snow globe, beautiful but desolate, not a person or pigeon anywhere. My pilgrimage was inspired by Wisconsin conservationist Aldo Leopold, whose 1946 remarks on a monument to the pigeon had, when I first read it, aroused within me such an unrelenting guilt that I found myself resorting the recycling bin 3 times through that week. Maybe it wouldn't bring back any passenger pigeons, but I'd sleep a little easier. How else was I to respond to Leopold's hard truths? that no human would ever again see, the onrushing phalanx of victorious birds chasing the defeated winter from all the woods and prairies of Wisconsin. I could have used some of their winter chasing on that day when I arrive at their monument, or almost arrive there. I don't dare drive down the accurately named Long Valley Road, so I get out and walk instead. Problem, though, is that I'd been too cheap to pay for the full-day park pass, opting for the hour-long rate instead, which means I have to hustle, really hustle, or I might just miss even the monument. Now, if you've never seen a grown man sprint through the trees, binoculars bouncing, I highly recommend it. That is, assuming you are not that grown man. Thankfully, save for a rabbit and a couple of deer, my tracks are the only tracks in the snow. A few steps shy of experiencing a coronary event, I at last reach my monument. I recognize it from pictures, a miniature monolith upon which rests a plaque featuring an engraving of our departed bird. And just below, a line that will soon have me absolving myself once more in the recycling bin. "The species became extinct," it reads, "through the avarice and thoughtlessness of man." I am still breathless, frantic, checking my watch. My time here, I know, is short. But so was the passenger pigeons, once we began alighting their sky with our nets and our smoke and our bullets. From my place on the bluff, I am at last eye level with the birds, though there are no birds, not today. What better reminder, I think, of our own mortality than a sky with no wings on the wind? 10 minutes later, I retrace my tracks through the snow. Still, no one is anywhere. No people, no pigeons, certainly no snowplows. The solemnity afforded by the forest provides little comfort, just further proof of what I'd feared, that our past transgressions were coming home to roost. The echo of the emptiness is deafening. Thank you.
Question or two? You know, we've got a little bit of time, and we've deliberately tried to read a little under, give us some time for questions or a conversation. So if you have questions, now is the time. Or comments, we welcome comments. Camp songs?
What birds are currently in danger of becoming extinct?
Boy, you know, there's a lot. My main resource is the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and Audubon, of course. And, you know, you can go region by region. And I think one of the motivations for me in finishing this collection was that with climate change, a lot of the ranges are shifting. And so there are more birds. Audubon is saying there are more birds that are now threatened with extinction because of that. But BJ, maybe you want to address that.
Well, I was going to cite the Audubon released a report of endangered birds or birds that were at risk in, I think, 2014. Something like 230 odd birds were on this list, and so it was a shocking number. And there were some upsides too. You know, we have policies in place that could help and all of these things, but you can't overlook that number. You know, and I guess the title of my book is supposed to kind of draw the connection between the future of birds and our own future, you know. And when birds start to decline, I mean, that's a real clear indicator for our own future on this earth. Canary in a coal mine is one metaphor that often was based in reality, of course, and I think it still holds true to today.
What advice would you give to people who are not familiar with the potential of bird extinction?
You know, I think one of the most important things we can do, you know, I'm going to answer that maybe in two ways, and I'm sure BJ has things he wants to say too, but I think one of the things we can do is just make more space in our lives for birds, you know, take more time to listen to them, you know, seek out quiet where we can hear them, and, you know, have a connection with them, with the birds that are here. I mean, I get the sense that's definitely what you were doing in your book, and that's what I've been trying to do too, is that we've lost some, but we still have a lot, and to be able to appreciate and protect the ones that we do have. In terms of protecting them, boy, you know, there's little things we can do, you know, and again, I turn to Audubon for most of my advice. They've got great websites on what you can do, but, you know, it ranges from the small, you know, putting out backyard bird feeders and, you know, fighting to get rid of the neonicotinoid pesticides and, you know, so it ranges from small actions to political actions fighting climate change, you know, and I think everybody, we can easily feel overwhelmed, right, by all the enormity of the task. And I think we just pick what we can do in our own lives. But I guess I feel personally that it's really important to have the connection to the birds too, and to maybe start with that, you know, to start with creating space. Our lives are so busy and there's a lot of noise. And just to create space so you can hear them would be a good place to start.
Yeah, I think Holly really hit it on the head there. I mean, you're right. Our lives are kind of filled with noise, and often, too often, it's not birdsong, you know? And so one kind of minor change that just kind of occurred as I was writing this book is I took my earbuds out for a little while on the way to work. So when I walk to work now, I just take a moment to listen. And when you actually stop to notice things, you'll realize there's a lot of stuff out there to notice, you know? But it's hard to train yourself to really be aware of your surroundings. I think we've kind of forgotten how to do that a little bit. And so certainly there are micro level things we can do and macro level things we can do, political levels and environmental policy and that sort of thing. But for me, I mean, the reward is very much symbiotic. You know, birds have done so much to enhance my just being present in a moment and to have a conversation with a person. Sure, I'm noticing them and I can log where they are on eBird and sites like that so we can kind of better track what's where. But for me, again, it's selfish, but I'm a much better human being when I'm taking the time to refill the bird feeders and, you know, teach my children, oh, that's a this, or this is that, and that's why we should care about that, you know? And so we could all be stewards in that way. Just introduce someone else, take someone out in the woods with us and, you know, let someone borrow our binoculars. And that's certainly what my mentor did for me, you know, some guy who he asked me what birding guide I used, and I had to refer him to the little golden book bird book that I had in my kids' room. You know, I was that bad. Still sort of am, but he took me under his wing anyway, you know. I think that's what we can all do, perhaps.
Yeah. I love that, the little golden book. Yeah.
Sorry.
Other questions or other suggestions? I mean, I have a sense that we probably have a lot of collective wisdom here in this room. So if people have other suggestions for what we can do. I mean, it's all of these issues are complex. You know, I was with the very first reading I gave, the book launch at Elliott Bay in Seattle, and you know, we started having a conversation about cats and keeping cats indoors, and that got it. That got a little bit. We almost had a cat fight. My cat doesn't kill birds, you know. So you have to, I think, choose what, you know, what you're able to do. We have a cat, and we don't keep her indoors, but thankfully she doesn't kill many birds. So, other suggestions, comments? I know Margaret had mentioned when we were out walking yesterday that, you know, some of the issues here in Minneapolis, the stadium, yeah, with the windows, and that mortality from that is pretty high. But there are things that can be done architecturally to minimize or diminish. You know, wind turbines, again, you know, I mean, we're all for renewable energy, but, you know, there's some bird mortality with wind turbines, even though the engineering is trying to shift so that it'll, again, minimize that. So there's always hidden consequences. Yeah. But I think, I don't know, I mean, I guess coming back to what I said earlier, I mean, I just think the important thing is, as BJ said, is to pass along the love to somebody else and nurture it within yourself. What I tried to do with my collection is just trying to keep the spirit and the beauty of these birds in our midst. They're gone, but their beauty, their calls, their spirit is still here. We can still appreciate that, even if they're not here, and we can still appreciate the birds that are here. I think that's that's the gift that this book, writing this book, gave me back, was that a much greater appreciation for the birds that are just part of my everyday, daily life. So, any other questions, comments? Pierre.
Could you say more on the topic of extinction?
I'm going to let you start this one.
Thanks for that pass there. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge subject. Where to begin, you know? I mean, you can, again, scroll through Wikipedia and just go like this, head in your hands, read some E.O. Wilson books, head in your hands, watch some TED Talks, wonder where is there some good news here? I mean, one thing to think about, and I think I need to kind of put this in context in my own book, and I do, which is, you know, extinction in its own right is a natural biological function of the planet, you know? And so, you know, a vast majority of the species become extinct as a result of these natural biological functions of the planet. My concern is, of course, the human-induced causes of extinction. According to some folks, the current extinction rate is between 100 to 1,000 times faster than in any time in human history, except for the last mass extinction. So that should give us pause, and that should perhaps give us another reason to, again, hit that recycling bin one more time or whatever we might do. You know, I don't mean to scare people with those statistics. And again, I'm just getting them from other scientists. I'm clearly not the guy to be, preaching on these issues per se. But at the same time, I mean, that's a startling fact. If you've ever been to the Chicago Field Museum, which is where the final chapter of this book takes me, I get to go behind the scenes and hold some of these extinct species of birds, including the ivory-billed woodpecker. I mean, that was an emotional moment for me. But if you go through some of the exhibits, there's a counter on the wall. Maybe folks who've been there remember this counter. And it just keeps ticking off extinct species. And that clock just keeps going. And I mean, I must have stayed in front of that clock for 15 minutes, just shoulders slumped and slumped and slumped. And you can only go so far down. That number never really reverses. I guess one thing to think about, and I know this from my research on Bigfoot, which is an interesting segue, is that there's still stuff out there that can be discovered. You know, every day new species are being found, maybe not Gigantopithecus, Bigfoot. But certainly there are still things out there to be discovered and to be recategorized and to be protected. So that's always a nice thing when you pick up the newspaper and you learn about some new species that we didn't know existed is still here or we noticed for the first time. Back to you. It's all the stalling I got.
What he said. Boy, that's a tough question. I mean, I have to admit that part of the reason it took me so long to complete this collection is that I just would get really dispirited and have to set it aside for a while. But, you know, I think what kept me picking it up again and again, you know, other people like E.O. Wilson, who's devoted his life to writing about this. And I guess that and, again, the beauty of the birds. And for me, I think it's art and I think there's a way in which the coming together of science and art are really important. And I think the more we can do that, the more hope we have as a human species. And so that's, I guess, what I tried to do. I'm not a scientist, but I feel that poets and all artists can reach people in a different way than scientific facts can. I mean, we're seeing how long it's taken people to accept climate change. Science wasn't enough, and I think we're really being called, I think the artists are being called upon now to speak up. And so I think that's what the role of the artist is, to speak up and bear witness. And artists and writers, that's what we need to be doing now. And the way in which beauty can save us, at least in a spiritual, in a moral sense. I'm trying to remember this beautiful quote from Wendell Berry, another writer that I greatly admire. And when he was asked about climate change or the kind of the future, does he have hope? And his response, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not sure I can quote it exactly right, but he said something to the effect that, you know, we can't know what's going to happen. We have to do the right thing because it's the right thing. And I'm just reminded of that, that, you know, we have to make, to me, it becomes a moral decision in a way. We can't know what the future is for the planet, certainly, but I think what art and the humanities can teach us is to live a moral life and the importance of the imagination and of art in it. So I know that's a little bit different response, but I think they kind of balance each other. Yeah.
Thing I'll say, and then we'll probably wrap this up. I know folks got places they got to go on this beautiful Labor Day, but just looking around the room, I mean, I see writers, I see musicians, I see a lot of former camp counselors. I'm one myself, and artists. Please hold your applause. Stay seated. And of graphic designers and art, visual artists, and I mean, in truth, it takes all of these arts and sciences to come together. I mean, that painting right there, which was on a stamp, I believe, that got the word out about the ivory bill in the way perhaps my words never will, you know? So everyone's got a gift, and so you can use whatever your talent is to spread that word. Thank you all again.